Welcome to today's CME Snack, and today we'll be discussing risk stratification for hospitalized patients with COVID-19. This activity may include discussions of products or devices that are not currently labeled for use by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, or other agencies. Today's learning objective would be to evaluate clinically supported risk stratification tools and clinical indicators to more accurately identify hospitalized patients with SARS-CoV-2 infection who are at increased risk for progression to severe disease. I am Dr. Sai Harnath. I'm a lung and critical care specialist working at Apollo Hospitals in India. I'm really happy to be sharing some very interesting information about where COVID's going. And I'm sure you're very aware that the pandemic is not gone in the sense that we still see COVID patients. However, the severity has come down and many people are now recovering from the effects of COVID over the last few years. But in addition to this, there is also the possibility that a new pandemic, new strains might come in. And how do we be prepared for something of that sort? So I'm truly a kind of doctor who you don't want to meet. I'm the lung and critical care doctor. You've got to be really sick to see me. And during COVID, we were so busy. There was such a lot of illness, so much of respiratory failure, patients in the ICU, patients in the outpatient area. And we all had to wear the masks and these protective devices. But truly speaking, these are really not something that we should be worried about today. However, the fact that something like this can happen again should keep us on our toes so that we are ready. And the simplest way to be ready is to have some knowledge about how COVID started, how did it actually impact patients, and what can we do to help move the needle in terms of preventing such a large pandemic from happening again. Now, if you look at the COVID-19 positive test trends, there is a fair amount of variability based on the year. And just like other viral infections, like influenza, there is a fluctuation through the year. Depending on the hemisphere you're living in and you're watching this, it might be winter or summer. For some of you, if summer is coming along, good for you. It's going to be warm and nice and sunny. But for many of us, it is going to become winter and it's going to get colder. And there's a higher predominance of the opportunity that you might have more of lung infections, more risk of picking up viruses. The testing of COVID has actually decreased to some extent because a lot of times doctors and patients have realized that COVID might be self-limited. It might not really affect a lot of your health other than like a regular cold, and people are ignoring to get tested. The availability of tests might also be a little bit of a limitation. It is not as easy as it was from before. But on top of that, it's also important for us to recognize that there are some patients who do need absolutely to get tested for COVID. They will absolutely also need to be evaluated, especially if they're immunosuppressed, are on steroids, are on cancer chemotherapy, or have other comorbid conditions. You would absolutely need to test them in more detail. Number of people infected may have gone down if the virus is not spreading as much, but that again is a little bit of an unknown because if you're not testing, how do you know? There are some clinical indicators of viral infection, some clinical indicators that this might be COVID, but it's going to be very difficult to differentiate unless you test for the influenza, for example, and that's negative, you might assume it's one of the other viruses. If you do some of these DNA panels, you might pick up a whole range of viruses which can be detected, and these include things like RSV, metapneumovirus, the influenza A and B, as well as COVID itself. Parainfluenza is also another virus that is often detected when you do some of the panels. In the inpatient setting, testing is continuing, especially if you don't know and can't recognize what the patient is sick from. And this might be somebody especially who's very ill and in the intensive care unit, because most patients with COVID are not going to get admitted. You might incidentally pick up COVID when you have the patient admitted for something else. And that is something that we saw even before. Now, the hospitalization rate as well as the ICU admissions are, you know, kind of varying. And as you can see, there were several peaks and those numbers have absolutely come down. And the number of new ICU admissions being reported by some countries is also a good indicator of tracking what was actually happening. But again, like I mentioned, the absolute numbers are down. And anytime you have a rarer disease like COVID is now, then you might not get accurate statistics. However, because it is easily spread, it kind of moves very easily between patients, it's important to continue to keep track. Now, if you think about a certain number, like say the population of a country, if you take India, for example, the median age is only 28. So a lot of young people, which also means that they're going to get a lot of interaction in the community and they might pick it up, but they're also going to be healthier. India has only about, I think, 75 million people or so above age of 60, which also means that in the next several decades, there's going to be billions of people who are going to get older. And as you get older, as you know, the immune system might not be as responsive as when you're younger. And also, if you have a comorbid condition, especially if you get an epidemic like, say, diabetes or hypertension, which is very widespread in India and as well other countries, then you have a higher risk of getting infected with viral infections, including COVID. But what is interesting, though, is that you're getting newer treatments for many of the non-communicable diseases, and it's possible that people's immunity might actually be better in the future. If you look at the ICU admission rates, also the absolute numbers are kind of dropping. If you look for the last, say, several months, those numbers have come down. This is already September, though, and we will need to see if there's going to be a peak like there was in the last previous years. It'll be important to keep track of this. So, you know, when we really think about, are we missing anything with all of this data? Is it pretty close to our experiences? But I think if you look at only immunosuppressed patients, I have a feeling that they might end up with a larger number of patients who are actually getting affected. Likewise, we need to identify who are the people who have, you know, the disease but are not being picked up. And this might be people with less access to care. These might be uninsured, people without you know, access to care in an urban setting, like in a rural community. It might also be people who are just working and don't have the time to go into a hospital to get checked or to a clinic to get checked. There is also going to be the ability to test, and the ability to test might have come down in many places, and that might be an area. In our area, lately, we are getting, you know, occasional cases. The variants are usually coming in from other countries in terms of when we detect them, and I have not seen anything virulent lately. However, if you're immunosuppressed, the possibility that there is a challenge is going to be there in terms of what you face. Now, in terms of hospitalization, I don't think there is currently a correlation between the kind of patient getting hospitalized into an ICU or a regular, just into the hospital, because I think the strains are slowly changing. I don't believe that there is a linkage between a particular strain and the kind of acuity of illness. So when I look at a patient with COVID as an outpatient, there are some aspects that we need to look at. And these include, are they needing care beyond the home? Are they needing care beyond the outpatient setting? Do they need to get admitted? There are many scores that you can do to assess somebody who's getting admitted. And these include things like the oxygenation score, we often call the ROC score, which looks at the saturation and the oxygen saturation, as well as how much oxygen they are requiring. And depending on the score, you can triage a patient. There are also other scores, such as the SOFA and the QSOFA score, which are commonly used in intensive care units. And that is something that you can use. There is also something called the NEWS score or the NEWS2 score, which is an early warning score which looks at vital signs and sometimes also looks at the alertness of a patient with a mental status. Specific to COVID, we have a mortality score called the 4C score. Now, some of these are not easy to kind of calculate, and you need to have a list of the vital parameters, and you do need some tools which will be helping to complement, not replace, clinical judgment. And I think in this era where COVID is not that common, it's important to use clinical judgment to see, do you need specific therapy? Because you might have a challenge in getting the therapy also for COVID, especially if you don't have a stock of, say, the drugs like remdesivir. You may need to have assistance to acquire those and keep a small stock of that available. So, like any patient who gets evaluated, we do need a patient history. And there you're going to need to have a conversation on travel, sick contacts, and then, of course, find out how they're currently doing. Do they need any symptomatic treatment for things like fever? What is their oxygen saturation? Are they breathing fast? If they're a younger age group, you absolutely need to look into that. And then also look at immunosuppression status. Are they currently on immunosuppressants like steroids? Were they previously on steroids, say, recently? Say, somebody with asthma that has been on steroids, or somebody with immunosuppression related to organ transplantation, or are they immunosuppressed because of chemotherapy and they have, say, a low WBC count? And are there any other special history features we need to be aware of, including things like out-of-control diabetes, any travel coming up? What is their vaccine status for other infections and any allergies that they might have? If they are a smoker, what is their lung status? Can they handle oxygen depletion issues? Like, say, somebody gets desaturation, can they handle that? When they get admitted into a hospital setting, then we really need to assess primarily what is getting them admitted, what is going to get them out of the hospital. So you need to look at the oxygen saturation trend. You need to see how much oxygen do they need and what is the ROX index to see, especially if they're needing to use high flow nasal oxygen. And what do you need to do in case they escalate in terms of their worsening or their breathing work? And then do you need to do things like intubation, non-invasive ventilation, awake proning, etc.? So when you're looking at the evidence-based support for non-invasive ventilation, awake proning, which you just mentioned, is a very simple way where you make the patient lay on their stomach to breathe. And sometimes if they're obese or have other injuries, for example, it may be difficult and you have to be careful to avoid pressure ulcers, and especially on the areas that are prone to pressure ulcers, like bony prominences, and you have to protect and support those to prevent any damage. The reason you do this is most of the lung is in the back of the chest. So when you lie on your stomach, you're actually allowing the good parts of the lung to work more, and you're improving what is called the VQ. So when you breathe, you bring in the air in, that's called ventilation. You breathe out, you're blowing out the carbon dioxide. And the Q part is what is, it's a term that we use for talking about the perfusion, which is where the blood is flowing. So there needs to be a matched ventilation and perfusion where the oxygen comes in and is taken into the human blood system by the blood flowing in. The carbon dioxide is brought by the blood, it is blown out by the lungs. So the VQ has to always match the production and elimination of both the carbon dioxide and the production and the consumption of the oxygen. So the lung itself has different VQ zones and different parts. And when you're lying back and you have infection in the bottom of the lung, you're going to kind of impact that VQ matching. So if you turn around and lay on your stomach, then you end up in a situation where you're able to actually give better blood flow to the part of the lung that needs more carbon dioxide be taken out. You also give better blood flow to the part of the lung that's actually working better. So this is important. Then you think about, okay, you're not able to breathe as well and your oxygenation is not improving with even proning, then you have to do things like continuous positive airway pressure. So if you're needing more than 40% oxygen, you need to do that. And what happens there is you put a mask on the face and nose and the nose and the mouth, and then sometimes only the nose, and you're going to put a little pressure to push the air in and keep the lung open. You then you're If you're not improving, then you think about things like high frequency, or sorry, high flow nasal oxygen. So that's a little cannula that goes in, and you give a very high amount of oxygen, and that is known to really go into inside into the lung and is able to really overcome the oxygen deficit that you have. You do need to give periodic breaks to avoid skin pressure. Also, the nose also can get quite irritated when you have these cannulas in, and sometimes you'd use things like nasal saline to just keep these areas open. Now, the treatment algorithm for COVID is fairly refined now. In the beginning, 5 years ago, we were very confused. We didn't know what to do. But now there's some clarity that one, you need to assess the severity. How much oxygen do they need? If they don't need oxygen, you need to think about, do they still need drugs like remdesivir to prevent worsening? Do they need any specific lab work? Do they need to have a monitoring of their indices of inflammation, such as a CRP? Then you can think about low flow oxygen if they're having a little bit of illness. Do you need steroids and do you need remdesivir? If you start needing more support, then you need to think about, do you need to add immunomodulation using, say, antibodies to COVID, which is again not being used very much lately. There are other drugs we'll talk about which you can use as people get sicker. And ultimately, if they get very sick, you need mechanical ventilation. You might need to treat them for ARDS, which is adult respiratory distress syndrome or acute respiratory distress syndrome, and that has a very specific way to ventilate a patient. So the respiratory support, nasal cannula and a mask, high flow nasal oxygen, continuous positive airway pressure. You might also need to use non-invasive ventilation BiPAP, which is bi-level positive airway pressure, especially if they have a comorbid condition, just congestive heart failure or COPD. You need to intubate them if needed. Awake proning for the non-intubated, but if they're very sick, you might need to prone them even if they're on the ventilator. The pharmacologic therapy includes steroids for all hypoxic patients, remdesivir if they're eligible for this, and of course, the immunomodulators include tocilizumab or baricitinib if they're not improving on the steroid. Rarely, in very severe cases, you may have to think about infliximab. So the adjunctive management of managing somebody with COVID includes thromboprophylaxis, and if needed, therapeutic anticoagulation, especially if you have a pulmonary embolism, or you have a secondary condition like atrial fibrillation where you have to anticoagulate. Supportive care includes, like any other patient, fluids, antibiotics if you need it, something to lower the temperature, and of course, you watch the kidney and liver function and adjust the dose of the drugs as needed. The treatment algorithm, of course, needs you to continuously reassess, and you need to keep looking at the lab work periodically, every 6 to 12 hours if needed, assess the ratio of the oxygenation and the FiO2, escalate the support if you need it, and anybody who's critically ill needs the other parts of critical care, including movement, dietary support, pharmacologic review, social work assistance, et cetera, especially if there are challenges in terms of what happens to the patient if they're not improving. You need to then de-escalate if they do improve, decrease the oxygen, think about how you would discharge them, especially if they have no organ dysfunction, the oxygen levels are improving. We do need to plan a follow-up and advise on residual symptoms. Now, there are some evidence-based guidelines for specifically using treatments, and these include things like dexamethasone, 6 milligrams every day for 10 days. Antivirals include remdesivir, especially for a hospitalized patient if they're needing a lot of oxygen. We talked about immunomodulators for inflammation management, including tocilizumab or baricitinib. By the way, these drugs are not new. They've been around for people with rheumatologic conditions for a long time, and they work with some very unique mechanisms. They do impact the immunity, and you also need to think about people who are going to be on this kind of immunosuppression for a long time, about preventing secondary infections. There are other options, including things like abatacept and infliximab in very specific settings. And you need antibiotics only if you suspect co-infection. Sometimes you can check the other parameters for bacterial infection, including looking at neutrophilia, high WBC count, although WBC count might go up with steroids. You may need to check special parameters like procalcitonin. You might need to do blood cultures and also look at chest X-ray as well as urine analysis if you're not sure where a source of an infection is. Now, a very unique feature in thromboprophylaxis is all patients in the ICU, in fact, many patients in the hospital, do need prevention of blood clots. And blood clots are common, especially when you have an inflammatory state, and you need to prevent it using prophylactic anticoagulation. Obviously, if they have kidney issues or bleeding risk or the severity is worsening, you have to reassess and see what kind of dose of a prophylactic anticoagulation that you need. And this is something that needs to be looked at in a little more detail because the studies are still telling us that if you're very sick, you should not be using high-dose anticoagulation. So the question is, are there any regional differences in treatment approaches? See, in India, for example, now, testing is still being done, but on a very limited manner, especially if it is not a classic presentation and you have an alternate explanation for what the patient is having. It'll be interesting to see what the US and China do. In the US, many places are doing routine testing if anybody comes to the viral process. And I think in Europe too, the similar kind of an approach is being done. Now, the fact that the seasons may be different in both Europe and Australia, it might be different in terms of the timing of the testing. But now that it is fairly widespread, there is so much travel, you need to have the ability to test it in at any time of the year. So we've talked quite a bit about what to do with presentation of a patient. How do you check the oxygenation? How do you deal with the evaluation of a patient once they've been diagnosed? How do you manage in the outpatient and the inpatient setting? And what do you use as their oxygenation gets worse? So let's take a case right now. So assume this is actually based on experiences over the last few years and patients we have seen. So let's take a healthcare worker, somebody who's exposed to COVID routinely, especially, say, a nephrologist. He might be exposed to patients who are already immunosuppressed or maybe getting dialysis. And say, a 55-year-old male patient, only prior history is high cholesterol and statins, and otherwise quite healthy and working out, et cetera. See, they present with fever on the first day. Their oxygenation is good. They do a test, and they do note that the RT-PCR is positive for COVID, and they have a slight increase in their CRP. Over the next several days, they're doing okay, but then they start worsening their oxygenation, and they then end up with a slightly low saturation of 92% to 93% room air. Their CRP is going up, the D-dimer is going up, and the chest X-ray does show ground glass opacities. And ground glass, by the way, I don't know if you know, but there's some bits of glass which are not clear, they're opaque, and that's called ground glass. So you literally see a little opacity on the CT scan, and they get admitted because their oxygen requirements are going up, and it's now 2 to 3 liters per minute. They're still in the hospital, and by that 8th or 10th day, They're still needing a little bit of low oxygen, and luckily there's no progression, and they have already been started on low molecular weight heparin for prophylaxis, preventing blood clots. And then slowly in the next 3 to 4 days, by the second week, they've recovered, but they might complain of a lot of other symptoms related to COVID, such as fatigue and weakness. And if they've not been moving, they might have joint discomfort, et cetera, because of lack of mobility. But it's important that they get their oxygen weaned and they're discharged. So what we saw here is that there is an importance to recognizing early desaturation. And it's important that you look at exertional hypoxia being a red flag, especially when they walk. And this you should use in other patients also who have lung issues. And then you look, think about anticoagulation. It is prophylaxis for all inpatients. However, like we talked about earlier, if somebody gets intubated on or on a ventilator, you continue the prophylactic dose, but you do not use therapeutic doses unless you prove that there's a blood clot. It's important to not escalate the dose when they're getting sicker. It's also important to look for other kinds of diseases. Even healthy doctors and clinicians may have other health in conditions, including cholesterol issues, cardiac issues, metabolic issues like diabetes. So what the key takeaway for clinicians is that clinicians can be patients, watch the oxygenation, assess for worsening of oxygenation, think about the progression of support with oxygenation, and do you need to add other drugs when this is going on? Look at the standard treatment approaches, which we talked about. Think about early intervention timing and what are the patient selection criteria when they need remdesivir or not. What are the gaps in early intervention? So some of the gaps might be assumptions the patient's looking okay. It's helpful to probably check the oxygen saturation to make sure it is actually okay and do some exertional testing. And then we also need to recognize some of the controversies about anticoagulation, how much dose do you give? And this is an area that is still being investigated. Now, then you need to think about, are there any persisting misconceptions and which people are still thinking about anticoagulation? You do need to use anticoagulation in patients who are sick, but you can only use a prophylactic dose. Once a patient improves and they're going home, you want to really think about what is a safe weaning plan, and then what is going to happen at home. How do you make sure that they are going according to plan for the recovery? That if they did get a bad lung infection, say they were in an ICU or very sick, what are the effects to include, such as scarring in the lung, and what happens in that situation? You need to think about the local rules for isolation and infectivity. Most places are very clear on how long to isolate a patient and when do they get back to work. There are also many policies about that, and each region should have their own policies on this. If somebody is high risk or immunocompromised, we should assess to see are there other things we need to think about if they're immunocompromised. So there are, a few I would call as a SMART goal, which would be specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And I think this is something you should take care of. I'm hoping you already know this, and today has only been a refresher for you. And the next 3 months, you can apply a risk-based assessment. So you would want to make sure that you're checking on oxygenation, correct timing of antivirals, what are the supportive cares you need. You also need to ensure timely initiation of all of these supportive care measures and oxygen as well as antivirals, especially in all hospitalized patients, and decrease their risk of poor outcomes. You need to talk to the patient, the family, the rest of the care team, so you can optimize consistent care, especially if a patient is transferring from an ICU into a ward or backwards from a ward into an ICU. And of course, you need to modify your discharge procedures so you have at least a couple of proactive measures to prevent readmission to the hospital. So you want to make sure that at home also that the patient is being watched for their oxygen saturation, and also checking sure that making sure that their comorbid conditions are well controlled. So we've really talked quite a bit today about the COVID pandemic, how it has decreased in incidence in many ways, however, it is still present, how our treatment protocols have become very structured now, how oxygen requirement still is a very important factor to look at, how there are a limited number of treatments available, but these have shown to be useful in the COVID setting. And of course, we talked about what we do once a patient is better and how to take care of them once they're discharged. Feel free to visit the Infectious Disease Hub. There are free resources and education for healthcare professionals and patients. There are several other programs in this series. Please check them out. Again, thank you so much for joining us. And of course, to receive your CME credit and the CE credit for this activity, you must complete the post-test and evaluation online. You will be able to download and print the certificate immediately upon completion. Thank you.